Comfort is often the first thing we're willing to give up, like taking a long flight for a vacation or waking up early for a workout. But don't let style be the reason you aren't comfy. Mack Weldon's Ace Collection makes it effortless to look put together while feeling truly comfortable. Inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, the Ace Collection combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. Upgrade your collection for the new year with bomber jackets, half zips, sweats, crew necks, and much more. Get comfortable anywhere with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Between the women's freedom movement in Iran in 2022 and 2023, and the horrific government crackdown on protesters in December 2025 and the early part of 2026, the Iranian people have had to deal with many things that do not fill the front pages of Western newspapers, nor do they demand the attention of TV news shows. In this podcast, Parastu joins me to talk about some of the events that have occurred in this period, and we also discuss some of the characters who have emerged as potential leadership alternatives. Unfortunately, the truth remains that one single voice for the Iranian people, both in Iran and in the diaspora, does not exist. The Iranians are a people who need to find a way to choose their own path without the influence of external voices. But will they be given that luxury? And will the regime that currently exists have the foresight to remove itself from the field? They have caused too much bloodshed. They cannot realistically keep blaming other nations for their own greed, corruption, and mismanagement. It is time for repressive regimes to step aside, whether they are in Tehran or perhaps even in Washington. This is Two and a Mic. Rise up and be curious.
Jepek kudwelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod joke mawoye tu under mic. Seche tin sudbuta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed ping biwawinje erochako domomit ndi
tu and a mic
podcast makende.
After a number of years, actually, I am very happy to welcome back Parastu. Parastu, how's it going?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me over.
Yes, I mean, this is only our third, and I guess because we used to do workshops together, I kind of feel as though we've done 100 podcasts together, because there used to be occasions where we basically had a dialogue and everybody else was just sitting there watching. But yeah, our previous two, obviously, you know, the topic which interests us sort of in common, in addition to other topics, I must say, human rights issues have always been very important for us both, regardless of where the violations may have occurred. But for us in particular, we've come to talk about Iran. And the last time we spoke, it was with regards to the women's freedom movement in Iran. And at the time, you were hopeful that the resistance and the courage exemplified by the women, but also by the young male support that the women's movement received, would in some way inspire significant change within Iran. Unfortunately, that hasn't transpired, and instead today we have seen in recent weeks, at least since late December, some of the most horrific government repression and violence against the people in a long time. Would you like to kind of take us back through the last couple of years in between, when the world has not been talking about Iran internally? I'm not talking about the exchange of weapons fire with Israel, but internally, the domestic issues which really affect your average Iranian citizen in Iran. Mm-hmm. In between the period where media has decided to kind of stay away from that, how has the situation developed in Iran?
So at the, I wouldn't say end, but towards the height when the height of the women-led freedom movement was basically over and media coverage was less, and all the violence died down, at least to a certain extent. One of the achievements of that time was actually that the police are not monitoring women as much with their hijab, at least in cities like Tehran, in the areas where a lot of more wealthy and up-and-coming people and young people live. So you've seen, like, I think the most of the coverage that has happened after the Women Life Freedom Movement in 2023 were videos of women walking in the streets, not wearing the hijab. That does not mean that there's no consequences, that there were not people that were imprisoned for that, or fined or jailed. But the atmosphere, what I've heard also from relatives and friends, was that it had loosened a little bit. And the bigger problem that had taken over in all parts of the country were the economic issues. So we have a country that has been sanctioned for decades, and the sanctions are just becoming even tighter. And the repercussions of them are felt by the citizens mostly. So we have the inflation rising every day. We have different areas in the country that are left behind even more. There's less infrastructure and less resources being put in there, also due to the huge amount of corruption in all areas. So that was the main issue that has been on Iranians' minds. Then we had the winters that were very tough with electricity, and then the summers came, and then there was another summer, which has been like maybe the 6th, 7th, if I'm not mistaken, summer where there's been droughts in Iran. And now the water reserves, they had reached, I think, last summer, almost coming to zero. I remember there were talks, at least the president, he was talking about moving the capital away from Tehran because of the water resources, looking at ways to disperse people, asking people to shower less, to use less water, instead of looking for maybe more large-scale solutions that people could enact. So we had all that happening, and then the second year in a row where Iran was attacked by another nation, in this case Israel again. And the significance, I think, of last year, the attack in June, the 12-day war, the so-called war, was that I think it's one of the first time, at least experts have called it this way, that there's been a big crack in Iran's appearance of like a nation that can defend itself, that can defend its citizens. So I think June was very significant in that sense. I think it cracked a big hole in the regime's facade that had tried to keep up. So the nuclear facilities, which are the main focus of the regime, they've been attacked. We don't know to what extent they had to work on them. I've heard that they've also covered them again, at least the one that was on the ground. It was for us, that's a positive thing to see a crack in the regime. That means that they might become weaker. And then months later, with the water shortage and then the inflation in December reaching a level that I think the country hadn't seen before, suddenly within a day or days, the people lost so much money. The protests in Iran, they never stopped after 2023 in some areas in the Balochistan, and the resistance against the regime, it doesn't stop. It is ongoing, just a smaller scale. And then December, it was full-blown, very similar to 2022 and 2023, that it reached many, many cities in other country with many different groups of people. And the country, I suppose, also being more fearful now since June, reacted in the harshest crackdown that we've seen so far, according to reports. And also the longest internet shutdown that is still going on. It's been easier now to connect to people in Iran, but it's still not full scale. The internet is still not back, and the VPNs are still illegal. So that is also always risk with trying to connect to your relatives outside. And the numbers vary from how much people have been killed and shot in the streets, even attacked when they were in hospitals and different facilities. Doctors have reported that they've basically seen massacres happening around them. So we have many different numbers coming around from different outlets. There's some Iranian diaspora media that always are one of the first to talk about numbers and incidents. We've heard 20,000. I think the government itself, the Iranian regime, has confirmed up to 3,000. But there might be a chance that the number is unfortunately much higher too. And they're calling for investigations, but at this moment, it's of course very difficult. Yeah, and we've also had the year with the highest number of executions in Iran. Over 1,000 people have been executed. So also on a so-called legal way, the Iranian regime has executed a lot of Iranians. And 20,000 arrests also in the last 3-4 weeks, basically since the end of December. So yeah, I would say that that's the situation in broad.
One of the things that I wanted to also sort of highlight is the water shortage. Essentially, when you live in a country like Germany, like we do in Berlin, where it's seemingly a kind of limitless supply of water, even in the summer. I mean, our summers never reach the kinds of heat that you'd get in Iran, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think even Berlin's water would be highly challenged if that were the case. But people, just to say that it's very hard for people to understand exactly how difficult it must be to try to cope through these long, harsh summers in a country which is suffering from water shortage. Mm-hmm. And obviously, this is such a basic need, hygiene, but also cooking, drinking. I mean, it sounds so obvious and so simple, and yet they are so fundamental elements of everyday life. If you can't drink, you can't cook, and you can't wash yourself, you can't live. And that can only lead to unrest. I mean, we had, just to say, just a silly example, a few months ago, they cut off the water in our building because they wanted to fix something. They didn't tell anybody. I couldn't have a coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. I went mad, you know. And we're talking about something which is a lot more serious and to which there is no, at least short-term solution. As in, if you don't have enough water in the morning, it's not going to change by nighttime, unfortunately, yeah, because of the way it is. So that in itself will cause the people to kind of rise up. Mm. On top of that, all of the other things, the repression, the lack of individual freedom and expression, the foreign policies of the government, which basically leave the Iranian people looking all around them, thinking we're surrounded potentially by enemies. The sanctions that essentially do very little to repress the government, but it does repress the people. Yeah. So from these perspectives, the suffering of your average Iranian is horrific. And any normal person would look at that situation and say, John, this is all my fault. I'm sorry. I'm going to step aside. Let's let somebody else come in and take over. People who are supposed to be spiritually guided, you would have thought, and I'm not going into a criticism of the religion, because this isn't a criticism of the religion, it's a criticism of the people who are there claiming to represent religion. People who are spiritually guided have to see the suffering of the people who are dependent upon them. And I still cannot understand how that's possible.
Well, you have a regime that just always refers back to external factors. So the sanctions, they frame them as unjust measures by foreign nations, that all the other nations are waging war against Iran and Iran's economy. So the regime's tactic has always been to not internalize the problems, but to look out and say, look, it's not our fault that the inflation is this way. If the US just would stop sanctioning us, if everyone started economic trade with us again. They all talk about nuclear bombs. We don't have them, so why are people why are other nations treating us this way? And of course, the people that are protesting are then framed as rioters and internal terrorists and people who are just disrupting everyday life. So this externalizing of issue, I think that's a big factor in how the regime copes with everything that's happening. And Interestingly enough, there are some external factors, of course, but they are caused by the Iranian regime. The sanctions don't come out of nowhere. I mean, the attack by Israel, it might have been a little bit unwarranted. I think there's been some analysis done that Iran had not attacked another nation, and especially not Israel. So there's something to be said about, of course, also foreign nations having a role in Iran conflict and internal conflicts. But it is all coming back to the Iranian regime. And it is not a government that cares for its citizens. I think that's very clear. You don't really need expert opinion on that. You can just tell by the amount of corruption that happens, by the amount of just authoritarian structures that have been put in, like telecommunication. Everything is organized through the government and through the regime. You do not have any kind of liberties when it comes to just living your life also economically. And the climate crisis is something that the Iranian regime cannot. It's not their fault that there is a climate crisis, but the management of a water drought, of course, and the effect on citizens is something that they can do something about. But if you don't have water and even your reserves are coming to an end, and all you care is put money into warfare or defense and nuclear facilities, of course, you won't have water for your citizens anymore. It means also farming is affected. And that means every food item rises in prices again. People cannot afford food that they could afford before. A lot of food has actually become a luxury in the last few years. So yeah, we have just a situation that has been simmering and brewing like this for many, many years. And the government just looks for tactics that are deflection. I mean, there's also cases of influences from other nations in the last 2 years. I've seen videos of people talking about traveling to Iran again, and look, Iran is such a beautiful country, and the food and the people. And while it may seem nice, I can also see that there might also be some tactic by the Iranian regime to appear more appealing again to the outside. So I think you can break it down to these responses by the regime towards everything that has happened.
Yeah, I mean, on a side note, and without in any way trying to reduce the severity of what the Iranian people have felt, some of the things that you mentioned there that the Iranian government has been doing pretty much as long as 1979, from when it kind of stepped in. I mean, before the revolution in 1979, throughout the 1970s, the religious leadership of the Iranian people, I guess the Ayatollah Khomeini, I believe it was at the time, who was in exile in France, and the messaging that he was kind of pushing through his representatives in Iran were basically to be very critical of the relationship between the Shah and the USA. I believe that also came to a head when the Shah met the president for New Year's Eve, and they were sort of toasting each other with champagne. And the pure luxury of the event, and outside the Iranian people were suffering in poverty and so on. And this kind of line, as it were, criticism of the USA, of the influence of the USA and the West in general, has been there obviously for now 50 years, as in, you know, come on, change the record from one perspective. You've been there for 50 years now. If you haven't significantly improved the situation within your country, you're obviously doing something wrong. Step aside and let some people come in there who are going to make things better. An extra comment on some of the elements that you just mentioned there. So, for example, telecommunications being run through government-operated facilities, and in general, the level of control. I mean, we can see through what's happening with ICE in the USA, where there are agents using Palantir-based software to manage the reign of terror that they've introduced in the areas which they are dominating. We can see this kind of software also being introduced in other nations. So essentially, we are, in the West, it seems at least, moving from this supposed democracy, which is not a proper democracy, but was supposed democracy, towards the potential of a repressive regime. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, and also the example of TikTok. a lot of people have been quite expressive politically on TikTok, especially younger people, and nations like Israel, nations like the USA didn't like that. They didn't like the way that these TikTokers were presenting their opinions so freely. And so TikTok was banned in the USA. And then obviously in Iran, you've got a lot of younger groups or political groups. They are using Telegram or I can't remember what the other software thing is, the platform is, but they're using Discord, sorry. So they're using Discord as well to create political movement. So for the Iranian government, obviously, the sensible option was, okay, let's remove the internet, or at least access to the internet, because then these people can't manage themselves. They can't plan, they can't come together, and we can catch them out. The point I'm trying to make is, unfortunately, when you've got governments made of people who are so undemocratic is the easiest term to use. Insecure, I think. They are insecure in their own abilities to manage and to govern, that they have to use oppression and fear to maintain their rule. And this is what we are seeing in the USA, and it's what we've been seeing in Iran, unfortunately, for much too long a time, and also a number of other countries. So you kind of must see that yourself, and you kind of perhaps also because, you know, Palantir is being used in Germany too, in some, in I think about three or four states. I mean, you must be also fearful of what could be coming here in Europe, you know, through this transition towards repressive technologies. But at the same time, the fear that you have for your loved ones, your friends, perhaps, who are still there, but also the fabulous country with a history that goes back such a long way. I mean, how sad must that be for you? Because the people there, there's so much creativity, there's so much innovation, so much intelligence, so much knowledge. Iran could be, or could have been, hopefully will be at some point in the future, something like a beacon for the region.
I mean, yeah, you're definitely saying it right. It's not just conflict in Iran, but as we are seeing a worldwide conflict in general, a move towards right-wing and nationalist policies everywhere, turning even democracies like Germany and the US into surveillance states, basically. And I also have to say, I don't want to make this sound like a conspiracy, but of course the Iranian regime does not have these weapons and these softwares on its own. So there's nations, I mean, there's China and Russia, but also there's been accounts of European weapons that have been used against Iranian citizens. So it's a mechanism happening everywhere where governments are somehow tightening their grip on countries. We have a president in the US who has very distinct geopolitical interests that he's pursuing. And he picks out a few countries in the Middle East and says, you, I do trade with, and the others are our sworn enemies. And I mean, Trump's role in the protests right now in Iran is also something that unfortunately we have to talk about, only because I've seen a lot of Iranians put some of their trust into him because of him saying that the regime should stop its repression against the citizens, and if not, then there will be an answer. A tough answer by the US, and then also sizing up its military presence in the area of Iran. So I've heard people, unfortunately, in my view, unfortunately, hoping that something will happen. I mean, the last few nights, actually the last week and a half, basically since he said it, every night, I think people are waiting for something to happen, some kind of attack against the regime, because they really hope that the regime will fall this time. Of course, they wish that every time, but this time I've seen so many people just they say this is the end. This has to be the end. I am hoping for it. I hope at the least number of casualties will result from this. So I'm not seeing any attack by the US as something positive, especially knowing how every time the repression rises in Iran and some government says something against it, the Iranian government tries to go the negotiation route again. I've just read an article 2 days ago in The Guardian where the president was basically saying, yeah, we need to we're open again. And I think there's talks scheduled with Qatar and some other countries too, representatives. So I'm not hoping too much that other nations will be able to intervene and step in and do something actually to bring down the Iranian regime. Instead, what we've seen every time there's been a conflict in Iran, that the other nations offer a hand in negotiation, and the Iranian regime takes. I mean, last year before the attack, there were talks between the U.S. and Iran. So the different interests that are here playing a hand, what you're saying also with the other countries and surveillance and the interest they have in keeping us somehow on the radar, looking out for citizens and their activities. It's as people are calling it, like a perma crisis. We're coming from one to another and everything is happening at the same time. The genocide in Gaza was also something that, of course, was on our main focus the last almost three years. It's very tough to follow conflicts this way, to only look at one country. It's also been hard for me to just focus on Iran. Of course, my family, my friends are there. But I've seen some people also try to say, why is no one talking about Iran? Why are all the Palestine people? And so the narratives online that I'm seeing are also not very productive, unfortunately, in diaspora. That also doesn't help. Which would also bring us to the next point. I don't know if you're also thinking of planning or talking about the one figure that in the diaspora that has been that has been interviewed on many outlets. So of course, everyone always says when people want to talk about an Iranian revolution, there has to be some counterweight. There has to be a name. There has to be something that can fill the vacuum, the so-called vacuum, once the regime is gone. And unfortunately, I think the reason why the last movement, the Women Life Freedom Movement, didn't succeed the way we wanted it was because the diaspora was very much fragmented. There was no coalescing around the group of people that had called themselves the coalition of the willing. So it was the son of the former monarch, Iranian monarch, and an Iranian activist, Masih Alinejad, who is also not really appreciated by all the Iranians, an Iranian actress, I think Nazanin Bunyadi, that I remember, there were the prominent faces. Also the actress Golshifteh Farahani, I remember her too, who lives in France. So that broke down, the coalition didn't work. Also Hamid Ismailyoun, the father of the victim from the flight, the PS752, the Ukraine flight. So this time, people don't want that to happen again, which this is my analysis. So they needed to coalesce somehow around someone. And the international news reporting and the diaspora reporting, they've only been talking about this one person, the son of the former monarch, because I suppose he's the only name that is out there. He's the only one who somehow has been building connections with foreign leaders, or, for example, the Nobel Peace Prize winner this year, the Venezuelan lady, Machado. I've also seen them meet with each other, both painting themselves as ousted political activists in exile. But unfortunately for the monarchists, there is not a lot of support around him. There might be some support. I'm not denying that there's also people inside Iran who think, we don't have another choice, potentially. He says he doesn't want to cling to power. He just wants to help in transition process. So whatever, there's no one else at the moment that we're painting to. And he's faced prominently everywhere. So he's been interviewed in German media. He's been interviewed in the US media, of course. So he's very willing to be a spokesperson for the Iranian people. I see critically, obviously also due to my politics, but also due to the fact that I believe no single Iranian diaspora person should have any say in the future of Iran when it comes to leading and guiding it politically. Supporting the movement in Iran, yes, but putting yourself into that country and say, I will help transition, I will be a guiding person, I see that critically. I've argued with family members and other Iranians. At this point, we all have the same goal. We want the Iranian regime to fall. We want them to be gone. We want them to face consequences for the atrocities they've committed. But the next step has to be to look into the future. And I wish for Iran a democratic future that doesn't have to fall back to history to fall back to someone who potentially is an autocrat or will turn out to be somehow similar to his father. I also see his connection to Israel critically, I have to say, which is also why the demonstrations here this time around, I haven't really followed them, because I see a lot of Israel flags. And I understand that an idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend is appealing to some diaspora Iranians, only because the regime has made Israel to be such an enemy. And I have no problem with the Israeli people, but I have a big problem with the Israeli government.
Absolutely.
And I've, for example, I don't know if you know Iran International, this big foreign diaspora media that is based in the UK. It's the, I think, maybe the most prominent diaspora outlet. I've written about them in my thesis too. And a lot of Iranians inside Iran and outside follow them. They have content in Arabic, English, and Persian. They even have an Afghani channel too. So they are building quite a big network. And they interviewed Netanyahu last year after the conflict, or I think it was during the conflict around that time in June. And I thought it was AI-generated video, to be honest with you. I did not expect Iran International to interview someone who is...
A war criminal, essentially.
Sorry?
A war criminal, essentially.
A war criminal, exactly. A war criminal is someone who is looked out internationally, and there's a war in the, for him. And he even said, women like freedom, Zanzanik Azadi, which... It was very tough for me to see that, to refer to a movement led by Iranian women, Kurdish women, different groups of Iranians in the country, and to refer to that, to try to then justify your military attack against these same citizens. A few hundred people were killed by those attacks in June, and they were not all regime people. They were not all nuclear scientists. They were ordinary citizens. So... it's very tough to see through all this web of interests and different parties. So I think that's why I will not fight if there's a coalescing around one figure, even if I don't like him, if it still means the fall of the regime, I can fight afterwards with the Iranian diaspora. I don't want the movement to fall because of that. But I mean, it's sad that this might be our only choice. The son of the former monarch might be the only name that everyone is discussing right now. So yeah, I mean, the protests have been a little bit smaller in scale in the last 2 weeks. There's been less reports. So yeah, I don't know what the future is. Maybe there were people really hoping for an intervention. But yeah, I see that very critically. U.S. intervention has never been a good thing, especially in the year that a foreign leader has been kidnapped in another country. I would not trust on that leader, if I'm very honest.
No, absolutely not. And to be honest, the relationship between Reza Pahlavi and Machado, as you say, okay, she may have received the Nobel Peace Prize, but this is somebody who is quite right-wing. she has supported attacks against her own country. I would never consider somebody like that to be in any way patriotic, let alone a good leader for their own country. With regards to Mr. Pahlavi, obviously, look, his dad was an intelligent, eloquent speaker. He loved speaking to the media. There are numerous videos of him doing interviews with the BBC in London, where he was such an eloquent speaker, and his responses, you could say, if you didn't know anything about the Savak and if you didn't know anything about what was happening in Iran, you'd say, wow, this guy sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that he would speak in such a wonderful way, and yet in the background he would be conducting repressive operations or managing them. People would disappear. People would get beaten up. Nobody knew what was happening. There was a huge atmosphere of fear. And a lot of people have forgotten about this.
Mm-hmm.
The Shah was not there for the benefit of the Iranian people. The Shah was there for the benefit of his own interests and international interests, even though somehow he kind of managed to find a pathway between the USA and the Soviet Union. So he was kind of happy to deal with both, and that wasn't very common at the time. But, you know, let's not forget that he kind of came around because of the coup in 1953. And US and UK, they obviously wanted to push their own oil interests, and the Shah was only happy to do so. So to have, you know, his son come back, as it were, having been, I suppose, educated in the USA, I mean, I can't imagine that anything long-term positive will come from the return of this monarchist, if not a monarchy, necessarily. But I mean, from what I've read, and also there's I can't remember the name of the professor, but she's a professor of I suppose Iranian politics. She said that she's written any number of articles and dissertations and essays, perhaps even books, I think, about Iran, political analysis. And she said, "I cannot speak for the Iranian people." Mm-hmm. And I have studied my entire life. I'm Iranian myself. And as it was amazing just listening to this woman, because basically what she's trying to say is the biggest specialist in the world would never be able to speak with the voice of the Iranian people, because there is no individual voice of the Iranian people, either in Iran or outside Iran. Mm-hmm. People may be against what's happening at the moment, against the current regime, but then, and everybody will speak against it. But then as soon as you ask them, okay, so who do we replace them with? That's when all hell breaks loose. Mm-hmm. Because as you say, there is nothing. There's no one. Now, maybe that's because the government has basically removed a lot of people from that front line as opposition. But there needs to be something. And I mean, reading around, there's apparently a woman called Maryam Rajavi, who's the head of the People's Mujahideen organization. I'm not sure whether or not that's particularly a positive twist. There's another group called Hamgami, which is the Secular Democratic, Solidarity for a Secular Democratic Republic in Iran. Mm-hmm. And this is a coalition that was established in 2023. But again, I mean, how much is the support for this? I mean, it's a great idea. They want to have free elections. They want to separate state from religion. They want to have an independent judiciary and media. That sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. But how are you going to get there? And again, it seems as though there are huge obstacles to that.
I mean, mentioning the Mujahideen, they are deeply unpopular everywhere. I remember being at protests, and if someone even thought this person was a Mujahideen, they would be kicked out. Especially with the history that the Mujahideen have in Iran during the time of the revolution. I mean, the idea of secularism in Iran and in democratic thoughts, maybe even progressive thoughts, I'm very much behind that. But we have to look at the context also in which the last 100 years have happened in Iran, and leftism, Marxism, communism, all the left-wing ideologies. There's very deep hatred, you could say, against them within the people. They blame them for joining, Khomeini and the revolution at the time. They blame them for also looking for leaders, other nations like Soviet Union, and, you know, selling out, basically, as what a lot of Iranians say. So you're starting with a base that is very unfavorable towards at least policies and progressive ideologies that are named this way. So it will be very hard to sell anything in that regard. And I think we might be anyway a little bit away from this kind of democracy with different parties that have different political ideologies. But yeah, I mean, the Mujahideen, they are very, 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 I mean, they're a sect, basically, a cult. So yeah, as you said, there's nothing else, no one else, no other organization that you can point to. Also, I think another reason for that is since the regime and its repression have been so traumatic to the Iranian people everywhere, there's no trust in anything. You could, I mean, there's people that appear, Iranian speakers. One day the Iranian people are behind them. The next day they say, maybe they actually have something to do with the regime, and they withdraw their support for them. As an Iranian, you have the state TV, you have state controlled everything. So the trust in any organization, it already breaks before even getting to that point. I think that's another reason why there's no other name or the figure that we can point to. The son of the former monarch is also not someone who's accepted in general everywhere. Also not liked. I think there people are just grasping onto this chance potentially because they really don't want this time to be like the other times. So you have a nation that doesn't trust anyone or anything because they can't, because they've been conditioned to be critical of everything. If I look at the other countries, and I don't want to compare nations to each other because the circumstances are always different, but Syria and other countries, if people are given, the citizens there, the chance to at least involve them in democratic processes, I think the Iranian people also deserve that chance. To just be able to choose. If they choose monarchy, then they choose monarchy. I mean, there's nothing, me as a person that lives outside, there is nothing I can do except for voice my discontentment. I'm hoping that Iranian people are smarter than the Iranian diaspora and very critical about the broader Iranian diaspora, because the people here, like my parents, they are frozen in time. They've left the country at a certain point. And as other diasporas also face, you are just stuck with that nostalgia of the time you remember, which is why when we talk about the monarchy in Iran until the recent revolution, we see its critical sides, especially as people who want free democracies. But they remember times where they had civil liberties. So, I mean, because most of them were part of the group in Iran that did not face repression by the Shah. And another step is also the father of the Shah, Reza Shah, is even remembered more fondly by a lot of Iranian diaspora people, because I think he had like a tough hand. He was leading the country somewhere. He was enacting, putting a lot of effort into changing Iran's infrastructure and modernizing. You cannot fight this nostalgia. I've tried, but you cannot fight it. So I am trying to be understanding of that, especially since I've lived my whole life outside of Iran. I've only been a visitor there. I hope that with the time that media literacy will come back, people can trust again, or at least, trust in their own judgments. But at this moment, it's very interesting for me to see the cognitive dissonance that Iranians also see sometimes. Is you really have this feeling that you cannot trust anyone or anything. So it becomes very difficult to even engage in conversations around this topic. Everyone is so set somehow in their view. I don't want to impose anyway. So I tell some Iranians in the diaspora that have been living here for decades, you're probably not going to live in Iran again. You've been here very comfortably living there. You would, of course, travel back and live there and enjoy the freedoms there. But we are also set now in our lives here that we should really take a step back and let the people inside Iran be the front and the dominant voice in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, as a person of Armenian ethnic origin, I mean, I was born, obviously, in the UK. And so, therefore, for me, when I was a kid, the Armenia didn't exist as an independent republic because it was part of the Soviet Union. But then a lot of people kind of around me were, now Armenia's independent, and we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And to be honest, the idea of me leaving the UK to go and live in Armenia was just a ridiculous concept. That was never going to happen. And I think people, even sort of the romantic visionaries, have to kind of realize that once you've lived in a certain country, it's very hard to remove yourself completely from a system that you have become familiar with. As in, we are creatures of habit. You cannot go from a situation where you, if you want milk, you go to the supermarket rather than going to a farm and milking the cow yourself. You know, that's a completely different experience. You know, or if you want to buy meat, my apologies to the vegetarians, but if you want to go and buy meat in, you know, for us at the moment, that's quite easy to do. But if you have to go actually hunt it yourself, then actually, you know, I will never eat meat again if I have to hunt it myself. That's just not going to happen. But another issue, and what you actually introduced there was an important point, which perhaps people don't really consider. So there are, I have heard that there are, as you said as well, some people within Iran and also the diaspora that want the USA and maybe one or two other allies to come in and liberate Iran and so on. And you know, people have to remember the USA supposedly liberated Iraq. They supposedly liberated Libya. They supposedly liberated Afghanistan. They supposedly liberated Syria. These countries are very far from being liberated. Some of them are under the sort of regional dictatorships of warlords. Syria is being torn apart by foreign governments, not just the USA, but also Israel, also Turkey. Mm-hmm. And people don't really realize that Iran would also have certain territorial problems if suddenly an American-led force were to come in, because you've got Azerbaijan in the north that has been sending out ridiculous propaganda over the last few years about how this or that particular part of Iran actually belongs to Azerbaijan, in the same way that they were doing with Armenia. That they're claiming that this building was created by an Azeri, but really it's been, you know, Iranian for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, and Azerbaijan is a dictatorship supported by the EU, supported by Israel, supported by the USA. And they would represent a significant structural threat to any new potential government in Iran. Not to mention, of course, Turkey as well would have its own interests there to pursue. So, you know, kind of people have to be careful what they want, because, you know, all these years they've kind of been looking at a unified national body that is Iran. But as we've seen, unfortunately, lines can be redrawn. Mm. And when you are suddenly released from that strong outer shell, then people will be quite happy to kind of pick at the soft tissue that lies in, you know, beneath that. And I don't think anybody wants to see that, at least if they are Iranian or if they support the Iranian people.
I mean, definitely any kind of lines being redrawn and borders changed, I don't think there's any support for it. There's, of course, people who are, they see themselves primarily as their ethnic group, like the Kurdish people, for example. They have a broader, I wish anyway, they want to have their own nation also with other bordering countries. But I've also seen a lot of reports that also these people still consider themselves Iranian often, because they've lived in that nation for their whole lives. And Iran is very centrally governed. Tehran is the center of everything. If you had a country like Germany, which is a little bit more federal, then you have conversations about Bayern being a state that can technically have its own economy, because it's everything's going so well there. Maybe that would be a different conversation, but Iran has been very centrally governed. Tehran is, there's, I think also with the surrounding area of Tehran, there's maybe like 11 or 12 million people living there in the area. It's very highly populated. I do not think people wish for these conflicts to happen, also for civil conflict inside the country. I think there's also been a fear with every movement. I remember, for example, the Women-Led Freedom Movement, there was a lot of focus, of course, on the Kurdish people, because Jina Mahsa-Amini was of Kurdish descent, was a Kurdish woman. And I remember some Iranians, I have to say Iranian nationalists, telling me that, these are separationists, why are we saying free Kurdistan and free this and free that? It's one country, we should just say Iran. I see that critically, because I want every I think group to have their own liberties, to not have to hide any kind of, anything of their tribe, of their ethnicity. But they should govern them. They should know what to do themselves. We should not have the US and other nations come here and tell the Iranians, we will keep you separated here and there if that's not the wish of the people. But I'm afraid that the US and other nations have an interest in that. I mean, Afghanistan and Iraq, they've been kept in this state of, I mean, it's not war, but it is a situation that is also not a peaceful time. And I think that's the future, unfortunately, for a lot of Middle Eastern and maybe also African nations, that you will not have them be like maybe full of wars all the time, but you will keep them in this kind of simmering state of conflicts and issues that keep appearing, to be able to extract resources for the US, for example, or Israel, other nations. And that would be the consequence. So I really hope that people are seeing that too, that any kind of US intervention follows a certain agenda, is definitely not meant to only help the Iranian citizens. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to have these conversations with people who either in Iran themselves have also lost hope. I've heard a lot of that conversation. It used to be more hopeful from my view, 3 years ago. People have lost hope. I mean, the economic situation has just become worse. And we are facing that in many other countries too, the crisis of affordability everywhere, but it is on another level in countries like Iran. Young people who are, I mean, I'm entering a job market that is not looking good for all of us. So I cannot imagine how it must be in a country where basically no one is on your side from the government. It cannot, the US intervention, any foreign intervention cannot be the solution. It will just lead to another conflict. It's always been like this, as you said, the other countries too. And Iran has faced that too. And I mean, the beginning of Iran's now conflict with the government started at the time when they found oil in Iran. I think it can be all traced back to that. So you have nations that are so interested in the oil in Iran. So the Iranians have never really been self-governed. The Soviet Union and the UK and then the US, they've always had their hands somehow involved in Iran and other Middle Eastern countries too. But yeah, I am fearful of a person like Trump, who seems to not even care to lie about ulterior motives. And it's just saying that what they wish for. Mineral extraction in Greenland or the oil in Venezuela that they want to have for themselves. I mean, there's US, Marco Rubio, he was talking about how Brazil and other nations are thinking of doing trade in their own currencies, so bypassing the dollar. And it was framed as something that is appalling. It should be appalling to all of us. We cannot sanction them anymore because they do their economic trade in their own currencies. And it goes to the Iranian case too, that I don't think there's a wish by Western nations that Iran becomes a self-governed democratic country that does its own economic trade. It's such a huge country that it could be very self-sufficient. It has been self-sufficient to some extent too. So I'm fearful that intervention means that this will never even appear. There will now be a chance at a self-governing country. But I don't want to give up hope, because why are we doing all this if we don't have hope in the end? I'm still hopeful. I have to be. Yeah. So I want to end on, after all this time, I wanted to end this point on something more hopeful.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's a saying in Armenian about when the knife touches the bone. And, you know, at that point, you'd normally look at it and say, okay, it's too late, because you've already been stabbed, of course. But when you're talking about a body of people, a group of, you know, organizations within a country, there's only so much that you can take. At a certain point, and this is what causes revolutions, of course, but at a certain point, you've got nothing else to lose. It's just, there is no other option. And we've seen now for many years, a lot of people, yourself and I included, have been saying, okay, this is the last nail. This is the last. There are a lot of nails in that coffin. Mm-hmm. And at some point, there simply is, you know, you're going to be putting nails on nails on nails. But at some point, it's enough. And so there will be a change in the Iranian government. There will be a change. The question is, what kind of change is going to occur? And will the Iranian people have a decisive say in that change, like they did in 1951 when they voted for Mossadegh? And will that change be allowed to exist under only Iranian control and for the benefit of the Iranian people? That is the question. If other countries stayed the hell out, then perhaps there was a chance. And I guess that's all that supporters of the Iranian people have to emphasize. Not the government, the Iranian people, they deserve better.
Yeah. Yeah, and all people. I think what I also would like to say that I've seen in a lot of Iranian diaspora narratives, that they only become very active when it comes to Iran and they see that as an isolated issue. But I think the resistance movements that are in the world and movements for freedom, they should go for all of us. So if you wish a free Iran, you also should wish a free Palestine and free Sudan and free Congo and other countries, because you will just continue having the same issues and conflicts if there's repressed people in other places. And the repression of another nation should not lead to the success of another one. So I don't want, which is why I'm also so critical of any kind of monarchy coming back to Iran, which might lead to imperialism from Iranians or the Iranian government then. That means the next group of people is then the victims of are the victims of imperialism, and I hope as people that are living in democracies outside of Iran, I would hope that we are all a bit more critical in our thinking, and that we see all of that in the same context of each other. But we have that issue with Iranians. I don't know if you've probably talked to Iranians. Very proud people, very very proud nation. So proud sometimes that it hinges on a feeling of being better than other nations, and I do not support that. So I'm hoping that the democratic thoughts that people have in the diaspora around them, that will guide also the future of Iran, just because in our understanding of the world, that might be the only way to having a free country. Even though the concept of free countries now is also becoming coming into question everywhere.
Yeah, I unfortunately agree with everything that you put there, and I also would hazard to declare that a lot of these movements are kind of interrelated, as in we are fighting against a global system which was already repressive for a number of nations. It's now becoming even more repressive under this new leadership in Washington. And if we're not careful, we could wake up one day to a kind of globalized order where there will be a kind of global revolution against what is happening, because it's just simply an unsustainable situation which is being forced upon people. So I believe in solidarity among different interests. I believe that those interests are based on fundamental human rights. They're not based on any form of or concept of supremacy. They're not based on any individual religion or religious belief. It's based on the species as humans, and we need to try to find a path forward which does not in any way require the exploitation of any group or groups of people. There are ways forward. We can attain this. But we need to be able to identify who the real perpetrators are. And I'm not talking about some kind of secretive cabal. This isn't the Illuminati bullshit. But these are the elites which are in every community, which are in every country. And they've been in control for far too long now. Neoliberalism has butchered society. And we need to be able to take all of that back and introduce better social democratic reforms, which believe in the solidarity of people and the improvement of society, putting a trust in the youth, giving the youth a chance, listening to their voices, and allowing society to flourish. And until we can achieve that across the board, we're going to have problems. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing. As you said right at the beginning, yeah, there are conflicts everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's never a day without conflict. And that saddens us, I imagine, greatly.
I mean, I hope that we all gaining this consciousness that who the actual people are, as you said, the perpetrators, that there is a class of people in the world that have vested interests in enriching themselves even more. I mean, conversations around Greenland also appeared because someone like Peter Thiel is very much interested in the rare minerals that are there. Because also AI, I mean, that's another conversation topic for itself, but there's a group of people, these rich tech oligarchs, that are now even more and more guiding geopolicies everywhere. And I hope that we can all come beside our differences and political differences and see who the actual problem, who the people are who are causing these big problems and who are benefiting from conflicts happening everywhere. Instead of fighting with each other, which is something that a lot of people on the left, we always do. There's a lot of fighting. We all, I don't know, fight with each other about the different views we have, but we can all agree, I hope, in the end, that the system, capitalism and neoliberalism, all these systems are not helpful for our lives. And we should not have a few people become richer every year, every day, while more people are being exploited and are suffering in the system. So if anyone wants the country to be free, they should be interested in a planet, in a universe that is basically, you know, non-following human rights and being guided by this principle of just humanity in general. We're not enemies of each other. Immigrants are not enemies of other people. We're all the same species of living beings. So I'm hoping that this will also bring us together, these kinds of conversations with each other. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot, it's a long road, I fear, and we don't have that much time with the acceleration of some of these conflicts. Yeah,
I can only echo your thoughts there, Parastu, and I'm ever grateful for you taking the time to come and talk to me. And I really, really hope that at some point very soon, we're going to do a podcast which is completely positive about what is happening in Iran. I'm looking forward to that day occurring. And I would love to have you there to talk about it. So thanks again. And I wish you all the best, as well as obviously the people in Iran.
Thank you very much for having me. I very much look forward to our next conversation when a free Iran is on its way. And I hope we see that day soon.
Two. Fingers crossed. Thanks, Parastu. Khodafiz.
Khodafiz.
Two. And a mic. Two. 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 And a mic.